People Will Talk. Welcome to the People Will Talk podcast. Joining me is Maria.
Hello.
And a very special guest today, a translator extraordinaire, Charlotte. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
We have a lot to ask you today because you have been working with Irene on a book called Papyrus. And it's a very interesting piece of work, but we'll ask you about that today as well, and also about other aspects of your translation career and your life as well. First of all, you mentioned just before we started recording that you have one foot on either side of the Atlantic in the United Kingdom and America. And of course, since you've translated this book, you're a Spanish speaker as well. So we want to start off asking you about that. So as a translator, when you see a language like Spanish, what are for you the possibilities of the language and the limitations? Because every language does certain things well. In German, for example, they have compound words. In English, we have lots of phrasal verbs. And when you see Spanish, what excites you as a translator about working with that language, and maybe what frustrates you as well when working with Spanish?
Well, you're starting with the most difficult question.
Gets easier, I promise.
I think I tend to prefer not to think about language in terms of limitations, which isn't to say that there aren't any, but that it can be more generative, and sometimes more interesting to think about what we can do in translation, right? So I mean, as you say, there are certain things that English can do that make it quite flexible. We have all these wonderful Anglo-Saxon sounds in English, where Spanish tends toward the more Latinate structures. So there's a difference there. Spanish is quite elastic in that you can make a verb out of practically anything. It's also quite elastic in terms of just how long you can go on in Spanish. You can have these wonderful, page long, labyrinthine sentences. I remember hearing an English editor who was working on an anthology of Spanish writing say something like, "What? How come they all write like Henry James?" And it's just because you can do that, and you have these wonderful long sentences in Spanish. And that, for example, is something I really appreciate about Nora Lang, one of the authors that I work on. So there are those limitations, but there are also all of these possibilities, all these new things that can happen when we translate from one language to another. None of them are going to map perfectly onto one another. It's always going to require a lot of creativity.
But you think, since you say that about Spanish, how you can turn it into like a very colorful long sentences, which I imagine sometimes it can be like a real nightmare to translate. But do you think, is that what attracts you about literary translation? What draws you to that sort of translation as opposed to something else?
Well, I think, I was... I've always been drawn to literature, and then I had the opportunity to learn Spanish, and so it was kind of inevitable that those two aspects of life would become entwined. But I think one thing that drew me to translation is just the enthusiasm of learning something in a language and wanting to be able to share it. Reading something in Spanish, this is this is something I'd really like to be able to share with English speakers I know. And then there's just the curiosity of, you know, reading and thinking, I wonder how this would sound in my language. Uh-huh. And the urge to claim a text that you like in another language and sort of make it your own by, you know, the sort of selfish, like, I'm going to, you know, put my mark stamp on this, you know, thing that I like, make a new version of it. But a lot of it just comes down to the sort of the sensory pleasure, right? Just enjoying saying words to myself out loud and, you know, putting them in different orders to see what it sounds like.
that's interesting. I suppose you also get to read a lot of books, so it's a nice job when you have to read books.
I guess I've answered the question in terms of sort of urges, you know, linguistic urges, but of course, as a job, yes, it certainly brings you into contact with a lot of texts, you know, from this source language, and it also requires you to read voraciously in your target language too, right? Because if you're looking for inspiration for, you know, a voice that you're trying to reproduce in your language, you know, you can find a lot of ideas just by being aware of what's being written in English and, you know, what's happening sort of in parallel or in contrast, you know, in the other language.
We mentioned at the start of the interview that you have a Anglo-American background, and of course, if you read, you mentioned Henry James, or if you read Charles Dickens, of course, these are writers who are in different eras, but I think it's fair to say there's a British style of literature and an American style of literature, if it's very crudely divided. When you're reading Spanish, as you mentioned, you read voraciously in your target language as well. I guess you pick up on that as well. If you're reading in Spanish, there's differences between maybe Latin Spanish and Castilian Spanish. And even within Spain itself, maybe you're seeing examples of how people speak the language very differently depending on where they're from in that country.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the joys of working in Spanish is just the many regional varieties of Spanish that are spoken in, you know, in different places. I learned Spanish in Latin American countries, first in Mexico and then in Peru, and I began my translation career working on Latin American texts, so that's very familiar to me. But each of those countries, you know, have a very rich, you know, idiomatic language, and those have developed, you know, separately from one another, of course. And then, you know, Peninsular Spanish is very different again. So it's very exciting to encounter a whole new idiom if you're working on a book that is from a country, say, you haven't lived in as much, or you're not as experienced with. So it's a thrilling literary map, right? From Spain to Latin America. In the last couple of years, I translated a novel by Elisa Victoria, who's a Spanish novelist from Andalusia. And I had not previously spent any time in the south of Spain, mostly been in Madrid and Barcelona and Salamanca. And so that was a whole new set of
it was a whole
new sort of colloquial world to me. There are instances where, you know, a dictionary is only going to help you so much. You know, you really need to sort of be living the language in my case at the time, it was there was a pandemic, so I couldn't, you know, I couldn't go to Sevilla and, you know, sort of go around asking people, you know, annoying questions about their colloquial, you know, language. So I sort of I did what I could, but it was a new area for me. I certainly learned a lot and enjoyed dipping my toes into that, you know, that regional variety of Spanish.
Yeah, I can imagine, because it's very different. But of course, suppose communicating with, you know, people that speak that language or that dialect is so important. And it kind of reminds me of, you know, when you're translating, I suppose, when you're doing literary translation, do you think it's very important? I would assume it is, but, you know, to communicate with the author of the book, because I suppose sometimes maybe you just get the document delivered, and maybe sometimes it's not even, you know, directly or even remotely directly from the person that you're translating for. But yeah, how important do you think it is? And do you actually get a chance to speak to the author and, you know, sometimes what people want to express in literary works is so personal, and it's useful to get their take.
I think but there are different takes on this. I mean, I think it's wonderful to have a line of communication open with an author you're working on, and I've certainly made use of that. With the living authors I've translated, I've also worked extensively on an author who's no longer alive, and that, you know, that brought its own challenges. I have I've often, you know, communicated, you know, extensively with contemporary authors with whom I've worked, on whose work I have been working. I've heard some translators say that, well, you know, once the text is out there, it's sort of its own thing, and it's gone out. It's an independent entity, and it's gone out into the world, and it is open to, you know, interpretation. I've heard that said, you know, and thought, that would be one way to work. You know, I'm not saying either is more valid. I think it's a preference on the part of the translator. Depending on how well I know the author, I try not to send them a daily blast of, you know, questions via WhatsApp, you know. I try to sort of gather my queries together, and, you know, exhaust all my own, you know, resources before I go to them with a question. Because sometimes the answer is there. I just haven't found it yet, you know. But it's wonderful to be able to communicate with an author and to develop a rapport and feel like an author trusts you with their work.
We are very lucky because we write books that are published in the Spanish market. Kid and I, but I write my part in English, so I had the privilege of Maria asking me every 5 seconds on WhatsApp, no, Maria, questions.
That's a bit exaggerated. No, but I think it's useful when you know the author. This is why we were interested in knowing what you thought, because sometimes it is useful, but maybe more in the realms of like poetry and that kind of thing. Is anything
Oh yes, as the poetry, yes, I would say that it's definitely a different kettle of fish, because definitely going into the realm of the abstract or the metaphor. We're going to talk a little bit about Papyrus now as well, because that, of course, is the big book at the moment, the big release that a lot of people are talking about, and we will be speaking with the author of that. But I wanted to ask you a quick question, Charlotte, about your name appearing on the cover, which I think is quite interesting, because historically, a lot of translators aren't recognized, but you, of course, are, which is the way it should be. So do you think this marks a change in the appreciation of translators, or do you see this maybe as a one-off event from the editorial?
Well, thankfully it's not a one-off I think gradually the industry is becoming more aware of what it is we do as translators. And there is increasing recognition of translation as an art form of its own, or, you know, a craft that it requires a lot of creative, you know, work, and that, you know, is in itself worthy of recognition, right? We're making progress, and it's great to see things like translators' names on book covers. Some of them, in fact, many of the more translation forward publishers in the US and the UK that have sprung up in the last 15 years or so will have the translator's name on their cover as a matter of course. In this case, I think it is not the usual practice of the American publisher, Knopf. But I had the good fortune to be working with an author who is extremely appreciative and generous in her recognition of the translators who've worked on Papyrus. And I believe that has something to do with why my name ended up on the cover. I think if it weren't for Irene's very public recognition and promotion of the work of translators, which is something she discusses in Papyrus, that might not have been as likely to happen.
There's an interesting thing about writers who are predominantly writers. For example, Shane Mancini, we spoke about him before we started recording the podcast, and he's very famous for working on and off and eventually finishing his translation of Beowulf. Do you think some writers are attracted to translation as one-off projects, because it is, as you mentioned, a very creative field, and it allows them to flex their creativity in ways they don't normally get a chance to?
Sure. I mean, I think it is. Translation is interesting because it is a form of writing, but it is a form of writing that takes place under a very particular set of constraints. I was actually discussing this very question yesterday with a colleague, and I said that these constraints are actually one of the reasons that I translate more than I write, you know, because I think that often we have this horror of the blank page, right? But if we are not confident enough of as writers or able to give ourselves that kind of freedom, then imposing a set of constraints can be very helpful for for what we produce. And so translation is kind of the ultimate set of constraints for a writer. It is creative, and it is, I think, demanding in a different way.
Now, you did mention, well, I have seen on your Twitter, unless you've changed it today, you have in your bio, "Sometimes I write." So we'd be very interested to hear about your experience with writing as well.
Yeah. I came into this line of work via academia. So I wrote, you know, I mean, I sort of have a history of academic writing, mm-hmm. both in English and Spanish. And when I left academia and decided, you know, that I would be sort of freer and happier just translating and writing outside of that institutional setting, I started writing, writing literary criticisms more freely. And I wrote, had a phase where I was writing a lot of reviews and essays, mostly about translations from Spanish into English. And then I got very busy with translation, but I sort of tried to keep up my writing practice. And I have a couple of projects in the pipeline. Definitely, I mean, translation is more, that's what occupies most of my time.
So going back to Papyrus, what do you feel? Obviously, it's full of so many interesting facts. I mean, there's just so much to it. So many details from antiquity to modern day, and that's a very interesting mixture of things. But what was the most interesting thing for you? You feel you learned while you were reading, stroke translating the book?
Oh my goodness!
if you could only pick one, I know it's really hard.
Papyrus is an extraordinary work. I mean, it's just an incredibly rich, digressive, and just fascinating book. I mean, it was a wonderful opportunity for me to be immersed in the classics in a way that I had never been before. I know a very limited amount of Latin and no ancient Greek. It's just never, wasn't ever part of my education. And so to be able to have a prolonged contact with ancient writers via, Irene's beautiful translations that appear in Papyrus was a really new and wonderful experience for me. And I hope that will also be the experience of a lot of readers, because I feel that Irene makes the ancient world accessible in a way that is really fresh and new and exciting. So that was one thing. The book is packed with really, really thrilling historic, anecdotes and tidbits, and we all think we know the story of Antony and Cleopatra, and we think we know about Alexandria and Rome and so on, but Irene's telling of these stories in a way that kind of imitates the oral tradition to which she is paying homage a lot of the time in the book, it brings them to life in such a wonderful, crisp and lively way. So I learned an immense amount. It was a very immersive experience. It took many months, and it was really just a delight.
Well, I can imagine. To be honest, I envy you for that, because it must have been like really difficult, to do it justice. But at the same time, I felt when I was reading the book that you're not only like, sometimes I had to go back and read it like so many more times, just one paragraph, because I realized that, you're learning about history, but at the same time you're kind of like learning about like how she writes and how she communicates. So you kind of like get lost on like, wow, this is like so nicely written, and yeah. And then you're like, oh, actually I have to go back and grasp what the information that she's giving. So I mean, it's no wonder that it's such a successful book, and she's getting to travel all over the place. Do you ever get a chance to travel so much in your job as a translator, or
I have been able to travel for occasional book presentations, and traveled also to book fairs The Guadalajara Book Fair is a major event for translators working in my language pair. Where a lot of rights deals happen. It's a way to gain access to a lot of new work that's being published, and so that's a very, very exciting place to be when it happens. But no, I don't think I have the stamina to do the kind of travel that Irene seems to be doing at the moment. She's very much demand all over the world, it seems, and I'm not quite sure how she manages to do that and also to maintain her rate of productivity. I see her essays coming out every week in El País and just think, my God, how is this possible?
Well, it's been a fascinating conversation with you, Charlotte. You've touched on so many interesting things for our listeners today, and we're very grateful for the time you've given us. So we both wish you the best of luck with the book and everything that comes after it, all the promotion. And I'm sure that the sales will be very strong. And it's a great book, as Maria mentioned, and we hope it gets into the hands of many, many people. So just for myself, I would like to thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you to both of you. It's been a lovely conversation. Thank you for the invitation. And it's a pleasure to talk about Papyrus. It's an extraordinary book. And yeah, I hope it will really take flight in English and reach lots of readers.
Well, I'm sure it will. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Welcome to part two of the podcast. So we hope you enjoyed our chat with Charlotte. And now we're joined by Irene Vallejo. Hello, Irene.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. Thank you so much for being here. So I just wanted to start off by asking you this question. So Charlotte mentions that some writers, when they see an empty page, it can be a scary experience. They see the empty page and they feel nervous because they have to fill it with words. But I get the impression when you talk about writing that maybe you don't feel stress when you have an empty page. You really enjoy the writing experience and it's fun for you. Would that be a correct impression?
Well, I am one of those writers who feel a bit stressed when I have to write the first line of a new novel or essay or anything, not on a daily basis, but yes, when I have to enter inside a new book. Because, you know, the first lines are so important, so decisive and I explore all the libraries and I have my notes bursting with the notes and I can no longer think of any reasonable excuses and I still put it off for a few days and I usually feel like a coward and I simply don't feel like I can. And you know, everything should be there, the tone, the humor, the poetry, the rhythm, and I don't know how to do it. And I feel heavy with doubts and besieged by uncertainties. And so, yeah, I feel the agonies of doubt and when I have to face the void of the blank page.
That's so surprising to hear, isn't it? I think a lot of people will be very relieved that, you know, if that happens to you and still you write so wonderfully, then there is hope for everybody.
But it has nothing to do with the result, you know. It's like your feeling inside and the fact that you've been preparing it and planning it for such a long time that you feel the responsibility of the first lines. And I think it's quite common to feel like this.
So we feel more human now. But one of the things you do in your book, and I think, well, we are big fans of that, they're all the references to popular culture, because maybe the purists will, you know, think, why do you mix modern with ancient? But obviously it's so effective, and, you know, people are showing it really helps them understand. So when we read your book, there are so many references to cinema, and, you know, reading, obviously, sadly, the writer Javier Marías has recently passed away. And I remember reading, like, his book, Hearts So White, ¿no? Corazón Tan Blanco. And in the beginning, there's this great scene, and I'm sure you're familiar with it, of this woman crossing the street in Cuba. Also, I don't know if you have seen the film Q as well. It's such a classic. And it really reminded me of that. And he describes it so beautifully, so cinematically, that you almost feel the smoke in the air. this was my impression. So for you, how big a part does cinema play as well when you write? Do you think, because you draw a lot of, from, you know, cinema references in Papyrus?
Yeah, I must say I'm married to a film producer, and he is the source of many of my references, and he also taught me this technique of the storyboard, you know, which is used by script writers, and this is like a map of the whole book with post-its of different colors. And yeah, it's the way I like to work and to plan my books, because the structures are essential for me. And Javier Marías, by the way, also came from a family that was very fond of cinema. And his father, the philosopher Julián Marías, was an important literary critic. And his uncle, if I'm not wrong, Jess Franco, was a director of horror movies. And his brother, Miguel Marías, is also a brilliant critic. And yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned this issue, because for me it's crucial to build images, to create images with words, and I do it quite consciously. I think this is the language of our times, and we cannot forget, we should not forget, that readers today have a profound visual culture that was lacking in the past, in previous centuries. So yeah, literature must be about captivating their attention, about being appealing. And that's why this bond to film and to TV shows and to visual culture is so essential. And that's why my essay Papyrus begins riding the roads alongside these horsemen, seekers of books for Alexandria. And it's a way to explain that there was a time when books were so valuable that a king would send his elite soldiers to fetch them and to gather them. But it is also a way to, I don't know, playfully disrupting readers' expectations about nonfiction. And my book begins almost like a crime novel, and it's closer to a 1001 Nights and the Name of the Rose, for instance, than an academic essay, a typical academic essay.
Yeah, it's brilliantly done, because the beginning is so gripping with this whole thing of the horsemen. And you really, I mean, I don't know, the first 50 pages, you read it in 2 minutes. It's really, yeah, it's brilliant. We were talking about Javier Marías, how he was really appreciative of translation. Obviously, he was very involved into that as well, and his novels and his characters as well. Translation plays a big role. And of course, Papyrus has already been translated into 32 languages, if we are not wrong, which is incredible. congratulations, yeah, for that, because it's so nice. But we were just wondering, you know, when your work gets passed into so many languages, do you get to learn anything new about your book that you hadn't considered before? And do you get to maybe interact with some of these translators?
Yeah, sure. I've just returned from the Frankfurt Book Fair, where I was given the honor of giving the inaugural speech. And this speech was a tribute to translators. And I said that thanks to them, we reach out other nationalities. And while writers create national literatures, translators have created world literature. So yeah, translation of books brings us closer together. And I feel we should vindicate and celebrate translators as truly writers, you know, not like, you know, people who is working to help us to be read in other countries. No, they are really, truly writers. They need to be so in order to do good translations. And it's essential that we demand progress for them. They should always be mentioned on the cover of the books. And I mean, the subtlety and preparation that is required to this kind of work should be better appreciated when it comes to paying their wages, because I think they are not getting what they deserve as authors. And it is urgent to change this. And in Papyrus, I try to explain the profound and transformation brought about by the project of translation at the Library of Alexandria, and how the Roman literature was born precisely with a translation, with the translation of the Odyssey. So our world would be different, and for sure narrower and more ignorant, without these centuries of translation. And for me, you know, I've learned a lot from my translators. They have spotted like mistakes that I afterwards have been able to correct in the original Spanish version. So they have even improve the original version. And I am always amazed by their intelligence and their intuition, because Charlotte, for instance, she instantly understood that in my book, the rhythm, the music of words was crucial. So she worked and she struggled to translate something that is very difficult, very ethereal, you know. And many of my translators have become friends during my promotional trips, and we are now in touch on a regular basis to tell each other projects and ideas and invitations and something like that. So, yeah, I feel they are my friends and my allies, and what they are doing is amazing. So I always try to celebrate and to recall the importance of their task.
And Irene, in the first parts of Papyrus, you write so beautifully and passionately about the oral tradition, which came before stories that were written down. And the oral tradition is still very important in a lot of cultures around the world. When you are doing promotions, as you just mentioned, or when you're in Germany, do you feel that when you're talking about the book, you're also playing the part of a storyteller, and the book has a life in those stories as well, beyond the pages? It has a life in this oral tradition as well of promoting the book?
Yeah. In fact, I fell in love with literature through oral storytelling. And my fascination with words goes back to bedtime stories. I was fortunate because my father and my mother, both of them, had an amazing talent for telling stories. And, you know, in these bedtime stories, they were acting them out, modulating their voices and gestures, and they were like actors, and I was amazed and totally captivated by them. And therefore Papyrus is a tribute to orality, and I like to underline that books have not cause oral traditions, oral communication to disappear. In fact, I think, and maybe you are you agree with me, now it's booming thanks to the new technologies. You know, I'm thinking of podcasts and radio and audiobooks, and its importance have never declined. Storytelling is about it's about seduction, you know, and we need seduction in our lives, and not only when we like someone and or we fall in love with someone, but also at work on or when we want to attract someone's attention. And since childhood, when my parents used to tell me those bedside stories and myths, I've always felt obsessed by our ability to tell stories and our thirst to hear them. So Papyrus is also an attempt to answer to these questions and to discuss these topics.
Oh, that's fascinating. It's been amazing hearing you talk about books and stories and storytelling. It's such an important part of our lives as well, for myself and Maria. And we both want to wish you the best of luck with this book. We're sure it's going to be a bestseller. It deserves every praise it gets. And we hope that lots and lots of people read it and enjoy it, which we sure they will. also. So Irene, thank you so much for talking to us today and for giving us your time.
Oh, no, thank you, Marianne, and congratulations on your work and commitment. That's amazing, and I admire initiative like yours.
Thank you so much.